This is Dead Stick Radio, episode 21, recorded Thursday, April 8th, 2021. Shiny Planes and Parachutes.
It's been, what, 3 months since the last episode?
I think about 3 months. And today we're joined by, how do you say your name? Kieran Tukey?
Kieran Tukey, yeah.
Awesome.
Villeneuve local.
Villeneuve local.
That's right.
So a couple... Oh, your microphone's migrating away
we'll,
on you
we'll
there.
We'll get there.
There we go. That's better.
So a couple days ago, you posted something onto, I think it was Instagram, a picture of this interesting silver-looking plane with the caption of 2 weeks to go or something to that effect.
Yeah, the Silver Surfer, 2 weeks, hopefully. So
what kind of plane is that you've got yourself there?
So it's a 1947 Air Coupe 415D. It's got a C90 in it with a wooden prop. It's got electrics. So I've just finished putting it all together, and I've contacted Transport Canada to get my C of A amended because I got new registration on it. So just waiting for that to come in, and then, hitting the skies. I want to get in the air so quick.
So how long ago did you put in the actual C of A for from Transport?
5 months ago.
Five months.
Checked this morning, yeah.
Ouch.
So. And that's a COVID thing, isn't it?
I don't know if it is or not. It's just a TC thing.
Just government, yeah.
I think it just depends on who you get, yeah. Honestly.
Where was the old C of A?
I had the old C of A. It was there and everything. I just had the wrong registration marks on it. So I said, hey, can you send this in, amend it, send it back? He says, yeah, no problem. And then I got an email saying, it's going to be a while. It's an old file. I thought, okay, whatever. Not a big deal. It'll be a month instead of 2 weeks, eh? So no, 5 months later, they're still, I think they have the file now and they're copying it or something. So I tried to contact them a whole bunch of times, and it's painstaking.
You know, it's pretty funny how the C of A in Canada is just a printed pink piece of paper.
Yep.
On an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper.
Yeah. Now they email it to you.
Yep.
Yeah. And they never expire.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mine, I had to get mine transferred over with my plane, and it was about almost exactly 3 months from the moment I sent it in.
Really?
It took forever.
Yeah.
So what did you have to get done on it though?
Nothing. It was just literally a sale of an airplane. And as soon as I sent the paperwork in, which I was kind of dumb in that I left it, I was waiting for, so we'd done all the paperwork, and yeah. We're waiting for, I think it was the C of R or something like that, some piece of paperwork. And sure enough, a few weeks later, it was like, okay, well, finally the paperwork, it's here. And I sent it all in. And by then it was. I had 3 months from the moment that it gets signed off to be sold until you can no longer fly it. And suddenly I was like a month and a half in. So I had like a month and a half where I just couldn't fly the plane. I was just staring at it because I was waiting for paperwork.
I've been doing that for so long.
Yeah.
Just more polishing. That's it.
Where'd this thing come from?
So I worked at the engine shop over here, Alberta Aero Engine.
Yeah.
And Lance, the owner, he had this plane sitting in a hangar over in Cooking Lake. And it's been sitting there for over 20 years. Nobody's been flying it. It's a heated hangar. It's beautiful condition. So we were bugging him and bugging him and bugging him. And then finally ended up getting it off him, brought it back here to Synergy, and got off the trailer, was checking things out and going over all the parts, because in the hangar at Cooking Lake, they had all the parts. The only thing we couldn't find is a prop.
Oh, like it wasn't together? It was a part?
No, yeah, it was totally a part and really dirty and stuff. But it was dry, right? It wasn't wet and corroded or rusty or anything, so it was really good.
And Lance owned it?
Lance owned it there, yeah. And then, got it off him and got it in my name. My registration came really quick, actually. It was well within a month. So that was really good. We got it here and just started cleaning and going over everything and going through all the records. And, you know, the really interesting thing about this plane is it has every single flight in the logbook back to 1947. It's so cool to go back and look over all that stuff.
It's probably all yellow.
No, the original logbook's like 5 inches by 2 inches kind of thing.
Oh, really?
And then they transferred it over and into the big, huge green one with the letters in there. It looks really nice, actually.
Who
I
want to
get
back
a new
then?
One, but...
Just some guy?
Gary Palmer was the last guy to fly it in 97.
Well, what about 1947? Or sorry, in 47 or 97?
Oh, 97 was the last time it had been flown.
Right.
By Gary Palmer. There's some guy in Calgary.
What about 47 though? Was it like Chuck Yeager?
R.L. Bradshaw. So whoever that is.
The guy who bought it right off the factory floor, right?
Well, somebody ferried it up here. You can just see they put XC in where the name goes in the logbook. But yeah, ferried it all the way up from Maryland, I think, in the States, Eastern States. And yeah, then this R.L. Bradshaw guy had it for a bit. And then this Gary Palmer guy had it for a lot of years after that. And all of his flights are just 1 hour flights or less, local. So,
names for people listening in the Alberta area, which is where the plane came from.
Yep.
We had an R.L. Bradshaw, who was a pilot in 1947.
That was way back there, yeah.
Yeah, and then who had it next?
I think it was Gary Palmer, I'm pretty sure.
And what year did that transfer happen?
I'm not too sure. I should have brought the books with me, actually, but
Gary Palmer owned it for, what, 30, many decades?
A lot of years, yeah.
Until 97.
Yep.
He quit flying it.
Yep.
And then somehow Lance acquired the airplane.
Yep.
Right.
So
it'd be interesting to see those previous owners, if anybody knows who those people are.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting.
Grandfathers or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. They can reach out to us or reach out to you directly and maybe see the plane fly again.
I'd love to take them for a flight if I could.
Man, it looks good now too.
Oh, it's so shiny.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a lot of hours of polishing into that thing.
So this thing it's legit 1947, like Warbird type construction.
Yep.
All rivets.
Yep.
Aircoop. Do you know anything about the company? I don't.
Yeah, it's an engineering and research company. So it's ERCO. So it's an ERCO Aircoop.
Right. Coop, like the car coop.
Yeah, I guess.
Right, because it's open top.
Yeah. So, they made them just after the war, and they were trying to get after all the vets coming back with, you know, money in their pockets and want to learn how to fly because they've seen all the planes over in the war. They were actually available through like Sears and Macy's and everything, all those big stores down in the States. You could just walk in, order one through their catalog. And
I saw the ads in the catalog.
Yeah, pretty cool. So
it's just like a car.
Yeah, that's how they marketed it. Plus, if war vets came back with no legs or something too, they could fly them as well. But I think their main focus was, just fly it like you can drive it. So they were averaging soloing guys in 4.3 hours in these planes.
Yeah, have no rudder pedals. That.
Yeah,
well, yeah. I was gonna say. So you mentioned they can fly it without using their feet. So obviously that means there's no rudder pedal. How exactly does that whole thing work?
So just on the main belt crank, it's all integrated. So as soon as you turn the yoke, you can see your ailerons move, and your rudders move too. It's really cool, actually.
They probably went out there and just tested it. And they probably just set it like iteratively. And just like guess and check on how much they need.
Could have been. Adjusted. I don't know how you'd maintain coordination at different airspeeds with that system, though.
Well, what would be funny
is... just be an average airspeed it works the best at.
Yeah, but imagine the test pilot trying to figure the system out. It's way out.
Honestly, yeah.
So this thing's... Let's describe it for people listening. It's tricycle gear.
Yep.
Lots of shock absorption on the gear.
Yep.
Low wing. All metal fuselage, just like a P-51. Large horizontal stabilizer with vertical stabilizers on the tip.
Twin vertical
with a P-38 looking tail.
Yeah.
Like a P-38 cool. Lightning.
Yep.
With twin rudders, not just the rudder on one side or something. A huge elevator.
Yep.
All polished. Kind of a bubble canopy, I'd say, that has a front windshield, and then the top part of it kind of splits open, right, and slides. Yeah.
So you can actually fly these planes with the windows down.
Right.
And you can take that middle piece I had in there. It kind of goes back and forth as a sunshade. You can take that right out and fly with nothing.
Wow. Right. So. Just like a full-on kind of convertible.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. So. And the wings are all metal, I think, with fabric?
No, they're... metal inside structure. And then construction, yeah. And then fabric, so...
And how do the wings attach? Is it just bolts?
Four main bolts and one to hold it all together in the back.
Are they just in the spar, four easy. Bolts, two in the top, two in the bottom of the spar?
Yeah. Just like any other plane, I guess, but yeah.
Just walking up to it, that thing looks like it's an Art Deco piece is really what that thing looks like. You see Art Deco pieces from the 1930s, 1940s and whatnot, and that plane looks like it came right off the wall in in an old fancy hotel or something.
Thanks. Yeah. I'm super pumped to to get it going, actually. So
it's got
to fly it around and show people too and talk to people. I love doing that.
It's a C85, you said?
A C90.
C90, Continental. So small engine Continental, real cheap to operate.
How much horsepower does that thing produce?
90 horse.
90 horsepower. That's why they call it C90.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's pretty much the same as what goes in a Cessna 150.
Yeah. It's actually quite comparable, like specs wise, to a 150. Like cruise speed and everything. I think it's about the same. I'd love to try it out first and see, you know.
Well, you're probably less power, but also no struts.
Yeah, very true.
But and everything else is
big,
pretty
huge
similar.
Landing gear sticking down.
I noticed that. You got big trailing link landing gear. Obviously, is that for crosswind landings? Because obviously with no rudder.
Yeah, that's that's kind of a common question for these air coupes is how do you land them in a crosswind? So you actually land it crabbing into the wind, and you flare it, hold it off, those big trailing link landing gear, grab the pavement, straighten you out real quick, and you want to make sure you have that yoke centered so you're not spinning either way. So when your nose touches down, you're going straight still. So I haven't done a crosswind landing in one yet, so I can't really explain it to you guys all the way, but if we do another episode, we could.
Yeah, so once you get your C of A, you're ready to go, aren't you?
Yeah, everything's ready, so yeah.
Wow.
I just got my annual signed off last week.
Have you done much test flying before?
So I went down to Lacombe. A guy named Sheldon Coulaway, he's got an air coupe. Yeah. Same year, same engine. He's got a metal prop, though. But yeah, I was asking him. I was like, hey, do you mind if I come down to Lacombe and just try it out? You know, go flying.
Yeah.
He's like, come on down whenever. So I flew down there in the Cherokee one day, and we went up in it, and he let me take the controls for 2.2, I think.
Yeah.
And yeah, cruised the Red Deer River down there, and it was awesome. And you know what? It's actually a really good performing plane. His was anyways. We'll see if mine is. But it goes 100, 110 miles an hour. Flies really nice for something you wouldn't expect to fly nice with no rudder pedals. So
yeah. What are the downsides to it? Like, are there any ADs or anything?
There was some wing spar corrosion. And then you had to put in these panels on the bottom.
Is that in yours in particular, or is that just a common air coupe problem?
Common air coupe problem, yeah. So just like any old plane you leave outside, the water pools in the bottom corrodes the wing spars, right? So luckily this one was kept inside. There's zero corrosion on it. Like, it's funny, you take off one of the inspection panels, it looks brand new inside.
And the fabric's all like the way you got it?
Fabric's pretty new. I think it was redone in 07. So somebody had the wings and wanted to get them going again. And yeah, redid them.
So what all did you have to actually do to the plane? So obviously it arrives at your doorstep, and it's like, obviously you can't just go and take it up flying. So what did you actually need to start doing?
So I had to get a prop first of all, because it didn't come with a prop. So that was a big expense. It didn't have any radios or anything. The whole electrical system was really old. It was right from the factory in the N47. So I decided to rip all that out, put a whole new wiring harness in there. And that was a really cool experience doing that myself. And it's a perfect plane to do it on too, because there's like 12 wires max in the whole system, right? So once I got that done, I got a transponder, a radio, dual comm actually too. Pretty fancy.
Fancy.
Mode C transponder. I got a new altimeter, compass.
So
just the basic stuff, really.
This thing's certified.
Yep.
How does it work? You're not an AMP or AME in Canada, are you?
Nope. So Jerry Boucher from 3D Aircraft in Cooking Lake, he's been helping me out a ton. So he's let me do most of the work, and then he'll just come and take a look and tell me if it's good or not. And then anything really gnarly that had to happen, he did, right? So like detaching the flight controls, tensioning the wires, and
The critical
wiring
things.
Those off, yeah,
but you can't get wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So he did all that stuff, but I like to keep busy with my hands, so I was able to do the rest.
So that's really good news for people listening, that they can buy a certified airplane. It doesn't have to be an experimental, and they can still do work on it themselves and restore it themselves, as long as it's supervised, though, right?
Yeah, as long as it's supervised and you have the right AME who's willing to do that, has the time to do that,
and trust you.
And trust you, that's huge. So, I mean, for me, working in the engine shop, he was obviously trust me already, because I've had my hands on this stuff a lot before.
Yeah.
But, you know, the only other downside to certified is the parts. You know, they're three times the price for half the quality. It's so frustrating.
Yeah.
You know, because here I got this plane for super cheap. I thought, oh, $5,000 will be good to go. Hey, meanwhile, props this.
Yeah, you're probably $4,000 in the prop.
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's ridiculous.
Three in the transponder.
So quick. The little tiniest thing is $100 here, $100 there. So I don't even have a final number I put into it, but
just close your eyes and just here's my credit card. Yeah,
exactly.
So
yeah, but very excited to get it going here.
What's your flying background like? Have you been flying a while now? How'd you get into it?
Believe it or not, not too much. So I don't know. My family's kind of been into aviation my whole life. My mom's had her private license since I was a little kid, and it was kind of cool standing in the front yard when my mom first got her license. My dad was pointing up and she says, oh, there's mom taking photos of the house. Ever since then, I just remember looking up like, oh, I got to do that, right? So after that, I got into FPV.
Drone racing?
Like RCs. Not racing. No, that racing wasn't a thing back then. but yeah, I did some long range FPV flights. So first person view. So it's live video feed back into your goggles that you have. So yeah, I had little autopilots on all that and a big 2 meter wingspan, drone basically. So I got that actually out 10 kilometers and back. And this is before all the drone laws they have now.
Yeah. So that's like a fixed wing drone then, not like a quadcopter.
Yeah.
I've seen YouTube videos of that.
Yeah. The quadcopters, I don't know. They're just so inefficient to me.
Yeah.
I couldn't justify it. So you know what? Give me a big plane. You got tons of cargo space in there. You could load that sucker up with batteries and go for, it was like an hour and a half or something. Yeah. So yeah, went 10 kilometers out, 10 kilometers back. And that really got the spark going for me. So yeah, that was all my RC stuff I did. And I thought, you know what? I need to get myself in the air actually. So I was looking at getting some skydiving or something or getting my PPL. But at the time my PPL was like 10, 12 grand. And I was just a kid. I didn't have that kicking around. So the next summer I actually got 10 or 12 grand from working. And I decided, you know what, I'm not going to get my PPL because it still costs over $100 an hour to fly. So I'll go get a paramotor. So I went and got a paramotor and wow, that thing is awesome. I bet you I got 250 hours on a paramotor.
So that's like a paraglider, just for people listening. It's a paraglider with a small little two-stroke on the back lawnmower engine.
Exactly.
And a propeller in the cage and net kind of thing.
Yep. So it's a powered paraglider. And so I was living on the farm and I could just set up right in my front yard and take off every day after work.
You taught yourself?
No, I actually went down to Wetaskiwin. A guy named Wayne Mitchler, he does the training out there. So
I got myself,
I don't have it anymore. I just sold it.
Well, I want to, not yours. I want to try like a basic junior.
Yeah, get a hold of Wayne. He's the guy. He's the man. So yeah, I did that. And then life got busy on the farm. So kept working. And then finally I was like, you know what? I'm not making much money. I'm working my ass off. Why don't I just go and fly? Screw it. Yeah. So then I came here and I had a bunch of money socked away. So I did my private in 2 or 3 months. I banged it out pretty quick. And then I actually ended up working at the engine shop over here.
Yeah.
And yeah, just picking away at my commercial and stuff. So
what are you doing now?
I'm lucky enough to work at Synergy right now. So I'm just a fixed wing surveillance technician.
Yeah.
So sit in the back, take photos, make reports for the clients and everything. So that's been keeping me pretty busy. And I just have my flight test left for my commercial now. So
yeah,
oh, nice.
It's going to happen pretty quick.
So you just kind of, so you've been doing the classic way of flight school where you kind of just do it as you have the money.
Yeah, like exactly. Yeah.
Pay per hour kind of thing.
Yeah. Don't recommend it.
when the paycheck comes in.
Yep.
Head over across the street, paycheck goes out.
Pretty much, yeah.
Into gas.
Yep. So I did most of my training like freelance.
Right.
So with Attila Racks there.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I've got to get checked out on his RV6. So did a bunch of aerobatic stuff and get your tailwheel at the same time. So
yep.
That was a pretty cool experience. Where is it going with that?
The freelance thing works pretty well, I find.
For some people, I think. I mean, don't get me wrong. The instructors are great. My style of learning, get me in a classroom, sit me down for a month, let me go hard at it and just get it over with.
Yeah.
So I've lagged it over the past year and a half, just doing an hour here, an hour there. Oh, it just, it's not working for me. So
yeah,
if I had the money or if I was smarter before, I would have saved more money and then just boom, put a big down payment on and got out of the way.
Yeah, that's kind of how I handled my PPL as well. Yeah. I just kind of I went at the Edmonton Flying Club back when they were at the city center, and I just hammered that thing out.
Yeah.
And just like I knew I could book in, you know, 3, 4, 5 flights a week and just get it done. And took it about the same kind of time frame you did as well. So nice and quick that way, and you're effectively not having to relearn everything every time you get in the plane.
Cause right.
It's fresh in your mind from the day before.
Yeah.
And whereas if you peck away at it and it's like, well, I'll do 1 or 2 flights a week. Effectively every flight you're relearning what you did in the past flight and then learning only a little bit more.
Yeah.
So 100%, it's really, really slow. Not efficient to do.
Yeah. So
what did you do for hours? So how long did it take you to finish your private license?
So I actually flight tested it 44 hours. I was before the minimum.
That's
quick. Or whatever. So,
well, that's a good example of, it's possible in the non-cadet world to finish your private license at the minimum.
If you have a little bit of interest in flying and have some, like, if you've done something else that has to do with flying, it comes so naturally and quick.
Well,
that's what I found.
That's a big question I get too, is what does it cost to do a private license? And that depends 100%. It's linearly related to how many hours it takes you to do it.
Oh, yeah. I think the average is, what, 14 grand now?
Yeah.
Like, I
and
did
what is it, 65
minimum.
Hours? 80 hours? Something like that?
Yeah, a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think I got mine for 10.5, which is a steal.
That's a steal.
Yeah.
A huge steal, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you had all the experience doing the FPV stuff, which is very translatable to that. And a lot of people now are doing simulators as well.
Yep.
That's actually how I really got started with aviation, is learning to fly simulators,
right?
Then moved up to gliders and stuff. People like out there, like, you obviously know what you're doing with this thing. You're not, you know, all over the place. So just having this kind of great experience, and obviously FPV drones is perfect for that.
Yep. 100%. It's not only that. I mean, even with the parachute stuff, it's a flight cycle is a flight cycle, man.
Yeah.
You know, learning to flare an airplane came so quick because I've done it a million times under parachutes. So
yeah. Yeah. Nice, you were very aviation minded already and knowledgeable before you got, you started renting Cessna.
It was interested, genuine interest. So
yeah.
That makes sense.
One of the hardest things to learn in aviation too is all the aviation law and stuff, figuring out what airspace is, what radio calls you got to make, and all this type of stuff, which obviously you would have a lot of experience with doing the powered parachutes.
Yeah.
Because now, you know, you have to do all that stuff. It's very translatable skills to a certain degree.
Not necessarily. I mean, we didn't really go into air law too much in my powered paraglide ground school. So looking back now that I know that stuff, I'm like, oh, probably shouldn't have done that.
What were you doing, like flying next to the airport?
I think one time I was in terminal airspace without knowing it. Looking back, over Josephburg.
Yeah, you wouldn't know.
You show up as a flock of birds on their radar.
Probably
so,
would, yeah. Harmless.
So do you still do parachute activity?
Yeah.
Is that what I'm seeing?
Yeah, right now. So pretty big into base jumping and a little bit into skydiving. Skydiving's kind of dying down with COVID because nobody can keep up with the planes and stuff. So mostly just base jumping right now.
How'd you get into that from power paragliding?
I did actually. Yeah. That's kind of an unconventional route as well. Usually you get 200 skydives and then you go out and join a first base jump course. So that's usually down in Twin Falls, Idaho. And then learn and you can get your own way from there. For me, I had over 250 hours in my powered paraglider. So I applied for the course and he said yes. So I was like, right on. I think I had 25 skydives at the time. So
you went almost straight to base from
paramotor. So it's pretty unconventional.
Almost.
So I applied for that and he said yes. And I was like, right on. That's cool. I've booked a week off work. And it was Miles Dasher, actually a Red Bull guy down in Twin Falls that helped me out. So went down there for a week, got 20 jumps, and then came back here, bought my own gear, and I've just been jumping my butt off ever since.
How did that work? So what's the difference then between base and skydive? Are the rigs different? Because you don't have
the
a reserve.
The rigs are different, yeah. So it's very similar to certified and experimental, if you bring it back to aviation. So the skydiving stuff is very certified. It's got to be inspected. It's got to be repacked every 6 months. The base jumping stuff, you got it on yourself. Like there's one parachute instead of two. There's no automatic activation device. You pack it yourself. You rig it yourself. You can do whatever you want, really. So it just comes down to common sense, you know?
So what is BASE is an acronym, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So BASE stands for Building Antenna Span. So span's a bridge and earth, which is a cliff.
Yeah, so it's basically not using an airplane.
Yeah,
pretty much. To skydive.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you have to jump off anything else other than an airplane or a hot air balloon or a helicopter.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's maybe an unconventional question, but what's the lowest height you've jumped off of for base jumping?
150 feet, just over 150 feet. Wow. Which isn't too bad. There's some guys out there that have gone pretty darn low, but like that's 80 about as or 50? I think 70 something. Yeah, I'd have to double check, but yeah, that's nuts. That's not my forte, really.
So what's the difference with risk, and how do you deal with it different compared to skydiving or aviation? Because down there, you have no opportunity to fix a malfunction.
It's true, and it's all about your preparation. So it's the 7 P's, man. Proper prior planning prevents piss poor performance.
Right. So you pack your own.
Yep.
Chute.
Yep. So you have to rig it specifically for every single kind of jump you're doing. So if you're doing a super low one, you got to rig it that way.
If you're doing it
a little bit higher, you have to rig it separately as well. So if you're going closer to terminal velocity, you want a slider on there. A slider is a reefing device.
Right.
So you put it up towards the parachute, and then as soon as you open your parachute, that slider kind of holds those lines together and makes the parachute just snivel a bit. And then as your airspeed slows down, that slider comes down, because those lines have tension on the outside and your slider comes down.
So I've seen that in normal skydive rigs.
Yep.
That's the thing that flaps kind of right above the skydiver's head.
Yeah.
And then there's usually a tie, like a Velcro tie or something on it, right?
Yep.
So base jump rigs
don't have that.
You just want to open right now.
Yeah. So we just go slider off all the time, really. But yeah, I've done all the objects now. I got my number and, yeah, it's just having a blast.
So you got your number? What's that mean?
So you can apply for your base number as soon as you've done every single object. And it doesn't mean anything. You can't get any special privileges with it. But it's just something cool to link you back.
It's bragging rights in the community that you've done it all.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So it's pretty cool because, I mean, growing up watching those videos, these guys doing that and dreaming about it. And here I am one day with my number. It's super rewarding.
That's amazing. So, I've seen, I think it's your, on your Instagram, you post on there. I think you posted a base jump here a couple of days ago. Was that the current one or is that just a saved one?
That was from last fall, actually. Yeah. I posted it cause it's like, man, I need to get back out there and keep jumping. So yeah, that one was down in Oliver. It was a 680 foot cliff. That was a ton of fun.
I hear a lot about, wingsuit base jumping.
Yep.
So that's probably just another level of complexity.
Yeah.
And you need a bigger mountain.
I'm not really into that because I obviously don't have enough skydives right now.
Oh, yeah. You need to be good at wingsuit flying first.
100%. Yeah. So that's my next thing, I think.
Wingsuit base or wingsuit skydiving?
Wingsuit skydiving first. And then in the future, we'll see about wingsuit base. But I'd love to play around in a wingsuit in the sky.
Aren't those expensive?
Yeah, they're pretty expensive. I think a brand new one is a couple grand. Yeah.
And are they custom made?
Look at the workmanship. It's wild.
Well, I bet.
It really is.
Are they custom made like for each person?
Yeah, they are. So you have to send them in your specific measurements and they'll make it. And you should see in the inside of their wings, they have like cords like an airplane wing does.
Yeah,
and it's all fabric. So it inflates.
They inflate just from the air pressure, right?
Yeah. So it's pretty cool. So I took my buddy's tracking suit off a balloon once, and a tracking suit is like, it's like a half a wingsuit kind of, right?
Right.
So it's like big rain pants that fill up and just make your surface area bigger so that when you get going down, you can bring your glide ratio closer to like 1:1 rather than 0:1. But yeah, the inflation in those things is wild. I couldn't believe it. It was so cool.
Like the pressure, you mean?
Yeah, the pressure in the suit. I mean, you get wind going in it at 120 miles an hour. It's pretty wild.
I did the math on that once. I think 200 miles an hour is about a half a PSI of dynamic pressure.
Cool.
Yeah. So if you have a 1 square foot area, you have, I think, 120 pounds of inflation pressure on that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wild. Yeah.
It adds up fast.
Yeah.
So what's the glide ratio on those things? Because that's, I guess, really what they're trying to get after is getting a higher glide ratio over the ground.
Yep, totally. So in a wingsuit, they're getting closer to 3:1 right now. So 3 feet forward for every 1 foot down.
It's not bad.
So I don't know if you can maintain that for very long, but they're actually being able to come down, flare, gain altitude a little bit, and then almost hit zero, and that's when they pitch and get their parachute out. So it's pretty soft opening. But wow. Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's wingsuit base is picking up a little bit more and more here in Alberta and BC.
Is it because of the access to the mountains?
Yeah, totally. We got some really good mountains here. So.
Like for that? Because I know it happens all the time in like Switzerland and France.
Yeah, Switzerland.
I didn't know there was anybody that did it around here.
Oh, yeah. Happens more than you think.
Wow. So. You just don't want to end up like, was it Jeb Corliss out there?
Oh, yeah, Jeb.
That was a rough video.
Yeah, Table Mountain, that would suck.
Yeah.
He likes to tell people about that.
Yeah, I bet he does.
So what's the next steps then to get into wingsuit base? So you have to do wingsuit skydive first? Like, you have to order a suit next? Or do you have to skydive more?
Later. Yeah, I need to skydive more first. So.
Oh, yeah. What do you need, like 200 jumps or something?
200 skydives, yeah.
I heard about that.
Yeah, so.
I was asking those questions, too.
It's kind of frustrating, man.
Well, and they're expensive, too.
It is, yeah, but jumping is expensive itself. You know, it's $50 a jump.
Yeah, probably all airplane time.
Yeah.
And you'd pack your own chute.
Yep. You can hire people to pack, too, but.
Here's a question for you.
Sure.
Pilot emergency parachutes. Like, can you pack it, or does it have to be like a special certified commercial rigger?
It does have to be a rigger
that's trained in those chutes.
Yeah, yeah, that's correct.
Because I know there's
I'm not a rigger or anything. Base jumping, I can pack my own parachutes all day long because it's the Wild West. You can do what you want.
Oh, because there's no certification.
Yeah. Skydiving, I can still pack it, but I have to get signed off first, which I think I just got signed off for that, so I'm able to legally pack by myself without supervision. But yeah, that's just for my own rig. That's nobody else's. So.
And who certifies skydivers? What's riggers. The organization called?
CSPA, Canadian Sport Parachute right. Association. So.
And there's another one in the U.S., I think?
That's USPA?
Oh, yeah.
I think it is. Yeah, USPA.
Right.
So.
And then, so these professional riggers then, they'd have to get trained in pilot emergency parachutes that each model, right, to pack each model? Because they're like round and old school.
I'm not too sure, actually.
The former Army skydiver instructor next door called it a women's medium.
Oh, yeah?
Because it's such a small situation. Anyways. Yeah. So you got to do 200 skydives to get into wingsuit base.
No, then just to get into wingsuit,
right. Yeah. And then you have to order a suit.
Yeah. Or you can have it already and start jumping it right away.
Right.
Like, get your 200, then.
Yeah, and you just go straight into it.
Yeah.
And then there's different performance levels on these suits, too, isn't there?
Yeah. So you start off with a small suit, and then you got to work your way up and work your way up.
And it's like $2,000 every time.
Close to it. But I mean, a lot of guys end up buying used suits, too. So I'd definitely start off with a used suit. Like, I have a tracking suit right now, and I bought that used for $400. So
can you get them altered, though, to fit better?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, you have to make sure you order one that's your size to begin with, right? So
yeah, as close as you can get.
Yeah, yeah. So, but wingsuits in the future.
So what do you want to do? So going forward now, you're working for Synergy. You've got basically a flying air coop. What's kind of the next big thing for you? Like, what are you working towards now?
I don't know, man.
Because you're doing your commercial. Yeah. You're getting into some really serious skydiving and base jumping.
Yeah.
Like, where does that path go? And like, what have you been thinking about?
I want to have some fun with it, I guess.
Just looking for the next adrenaline hit, basically.
No, not necessarily. It's the accomplishment, not just the adrenaline.
Well, yeah, you've got a lot of paths right now and options that you can take, I think.
There's so many doors open, and it's really tough to pick, honestly. I don't know. Do I go get my helicopter license?
Cool. Is that what you're leaning towards?
I kind of think so, yeah. We'll see.
And being a professional pilot and recreational wingsuit base jump?
Yep. Okay. Well, I'm going to be a professional pilot no matter what, I think.
It's just a matter of what kind of pilot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
But you wouldn't be like a professional wingsuit guy. Sponsored
by GoPro.
It's pretty
tough to get
into
that now. Like, you got to be broke for 20 years and then make it.
I was about to say, it seems like professional wakeboarding or something.
Yeah,
like back in the day, I was all into that.
Yeah.
But like, man, there's only like 20 of them and most of them are not wealthy.
Yeah. Even the top guys.
And I imagine that's the same in smaller extreme sports like wingsuit base jumping too.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Like, you can make great videos and cool videos.
Yeah.
But also, like, what's like the chance of dying is like 10%, right? Or something crazy high. And
It's higher than walking down the street.
Yeah.
The market is small enough that I imagine generating income is tough.
I would imagine that too. Yeah, a lot of guys end up doing like commercial work and stuff. But still, I can't see that paying that much. So I'm going to just be a pilot, I think, and have fun with it, see where that leads me. We'll see.
Just do some of the fun adrenaline stuff on the side. And
Yeah, exactly. So, but I just got to get this plane going first so I can fly around and meet other people and talk to people. And that's how you get the jobs right there. You never know how you get a cool job. It's walking around and talking.
Man, owning an airplane opened up so many doors for me.
I bet, yeah.
Like where we're sitting even, meeting Eldon.
Yep.
Like meeting all these people all over the place would not happen if I was renting from a flight school.
Yep.
That's such a big deal.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't understand that.
Brainwash you into just renting from them, you know. It was frowned upon to go rent somebody else's airplane, but no way. Go explore. Have some fun flying different kinds of aircraft. Don't just fly 172.
Yeah, and far away.
Walk around and talk to people. You'd be surprised how many old guys there are on the field that they would let you fly their plane.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Well, and even just when buying my plane's not that particularly special, but I'll tell you, it's special enough that people take notice. And I can't walk around here without someone going, "You're the Buccaneer guy, right?
Yeah,
you're the Buccaneer guy with the podcast." Yeah. I used to have one of those planes, or I really love those planes or whatever.
Yeah.
Just buying something that's not a Cessna is just mind-blowing for a lot of people. There's you know, people can go and buy a Cessna 152 or whatever for what, 25,000-30,000 or something, but that's kind of a boring little plane, whereas you buy something like an air coupe or get to build, you know, restore your own air coupe, and that's a cool plane. Everyone around this airport certainly knows that plane exists. And everyone's waiting for that thing to fly.
It's gonna be pretty cool.
One thing important to me, I think, is having goals and expanding my knowledge and my skills in aviation, right?
Yeah.
And I think Cessna 172s and those kinds of airplanes only take you so far, where the value per hour that you get starts to diminish quickly. You keep learning about weather and all these interesting situations, but your actual stick and rudder skills and your technical skills and your decision-making skills that kind of thing kind of plateaus early.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're kind of limiting.
I learned a ton flying that RV6, the tail dragger, and man, you can really screw up, but it's cool to get that actual stick and rudder skills.
Yeah.
You know, you can fly a Cessna 172 without the rudder pedals any day.
Take
off and land without them, no problem.
You have an Hop airplane in an that RV6 doesn't have
and do that? Not so much.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, and the RV2 is still like what I'd consider a pussycat of a tail dragger.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine a hard flying airplane. A Cessna. That'd be cool.
Or like even getting it, like going from an RV into a Pitts or something is such a big leap.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't fully understand the difference and why it's so different and the different skills that each plane teaches you.
Yeah, I can't wait to learn the difference.
And like exotic airplanes, like even flying sailplanes teaches so much.
Yeah.
Compared to what people around here know or the average student around here is learning.
Yeah. Like I said before, from every different kind of aviation, or not even aviation, flying in general, it'll all relate back to one somehow.
And I think you're a perfect example of that. With your success in finishing your private license so quick, it's because you already knew a lot of the basics and kind of like, you know, how the weather works, how the wind works, turbulence, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
How to flare, basic aviation.
Yeah. So then, principles. You have your license to learn. It was really easy to get that, but then the commercial made it a lot harder.
Well,
so you come out of it with all this confidence. Oh, yeah, I got it, right?
You're good until you're not anymore.
Holy moly.
I know. Man,
learn a lot more.
That will always be that way, I think.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how good you are, somebody's always better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's exciting to learn more and more, though, too.
What I really like, too, about this airport is there's a lot of people that challenge each other.
Yeah.
And, like, push each other and make it exciting to be here.
Yeah.
And then the airport itself is set up so well for that kind of sport flying and trying to push each other's boundaries and grow as kind of a community. Yeah. It's a really perfect place for the kind of thing that what you're doing, what we're doing.
Yeah.
What some of the other people in the field are doing.
I agree. Yeah. I'd really like to get in one of those little race planes like you got there. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Especially if you can get something working out here for that.
Yeah. And it sounds to me like you've got like decent tailwheel skills. So there could be some of those opportunities coming up.
Yep. We'll see. Let me fly the air coupe for a year.
Yeah, exactly. Make your feet really lazy.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. You planning to take that thing down to Oshkosh?
Oh, man. Lend me the money for that.
That's that a lot ADS-B. Of gas. A
lot of gas, a lot of time in that thing, yeah.
I'm not worried about the gas, really. That's I think it's like $30 an hour. So that's not too bad. But yeah, the ADS-B, I really want to get something like that. Like we were talking about earlier, the AV30 with the Diversity X.
Yeah, the tail beacon X attached to, yeah. Beacon.
That would be cool. Ditch through transponder you got in there. That'll save me a bunch of weight. Encoder and everything.
Yeah.
Well, you can still get to Oshkosh though without, right? Because we got to talk about
that. Are the legalities on that? Can I get into the States without ADS-B? Or
that's a good question.
You can. It's difficult, but you can. So normally you have to call ahead and tell them you're coming across with it. But the moment you get across that border, even if you do, when you do get across that border and they allow you past, you can't go anywhere near their, what is it, Class Bravo, I think is what they call it in the States, which is equivalent to our Class Charlie.
Yeah.
Exactly, the ADS-B zones, which is a significant portion of the States, right? A lot of the bigger airports, there's not a ton of airports down there that have any kind of services like fuel or mechanics or anything that aren't within those veils. And it's, I'd imagine you could probably talk to the air traffic controllers and probably get them to let you in, but if they say no,
you're screwed.
If they say no, you're really screwed. Exactly. So to me, that was I ordered the Tail Beacon X the moment they announced it, and I'm still waiting on it. It's coming. They've just I think got STC for it. They're just waiting for the AML.
So is that just ADS-B out?
So it's ADS-B out, but it's also mode S transponder and a mode C transponder.
Okay. So is there any way to get ADS-B in on that as well?
Not on the unit itself. So what I'm doing is I have a Sentry, a Stratus. I got a Stratus, but you can do it with the Sentry, which are a little bit cheaper. And then you can connect it to an iPad and you're good to go.
Yeah, I've heard about that. I'd really like one of those anyways.
But to clarify what you just said, I have friends that do not have ADS-B, just the mode C transponder.
Yeah.
That fly all over the U.S. without issues.
But they're already down there.
No, they're Canadian from Edmonton. You do not need ADS-B to cross the border.
Yeah.
You need a transponder.
You need to clarify this somehow.
You need a transponder.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But you can also apply in advance, I think 60 days notice, to cross the border without a transponder. You just have to tell them when and the route of flight.
Really?
Yeah, okay. So I've had friends with racers
that
brought racers back from the U.S., that have no transponder at all. All they have to do is tell the border that they're coming and file all that in advance.
Yeah.
So to clarify, you do not need ADS-B, I believe. And you still don't.
It's exactly. It is.
You just mode C.
Exactly. You don't you don't need it, but it makes it a lot easier if you have
it. Can you stop at airports with fuel if you don't have?
Yes. There's some, gazillion with fuel. So remember, you can't fly in the U.S. more than 10 miles from an airport, pretty much. Airports everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not much.
Not much.
And the small airports are very well set up for general aviation. So my friends have no problem flying all over the place. The problem is if you have an electrical system, you can't get far or closer than about 30 nautical miles from any major city like New York or Dallas or Denver or whatever.
It's not cool anyways.
Yeah. But all the other cities, no problem.
Okay.
If you have no electric and you might qualify for that, you have to look up what that means. There's an exemption.
Huh.
Well, yeah, and there's special rules too for people crossing the borders and stuff. So planes from other jurisdictions, like for example, this new 406 ELT mandate in Canada that we're going to have to be under. If people fly up from the States into Canada, they're going to be required to have a 406 ELT. Now, for us in Canada, we're required to have a fixed one or an emergency one. There's a few different specs we have to have. But if you're flying from the States, you're allowed to still have your 121.5 ELT, and then you're allowed to actually it's a portable handheld ELT, so you don't have to have one actually installed. So there's these weird kind of cross border rules that they have, and I don't know all the intricacies of that one. And to me, it's like, for me, I'm just like, you know, I want to go to the back and forth to the States, so I'm just going to put an ADS-B. The biggest difficulty is all these people in Canada here who have installed ADS-B, these standard ADS-B systems that are just mode S out and ADS-B out. But they're built on the American system where they don't have to connect to the satellites, and the satellites can sometimes pick them up, but because the antennas are on the bottom of the wing typically or the bottom of the hull, they have very little coverage of the sky, and they're not very good coverage of the sky. So they end up basically flying around in Canada visible. Wow. And they've basically spent $3,000-$5,000 to install these things, and now they have to completely scrap it because there's no upgrade pass, especially for any of the Garmin stuff. There's no upgrade paths at all.
Right. So would that be like the old tail beacon, like the normal tail beacon?
Yeah, the original tail beacon. Now, okay. I think there is some, those ones are fairly easy to upgrade because it's effectively you unplug the old one, plug in the new one, and then you can sell the old tail beacon off to the States. There's people in the States who will buy them, no problem, at a you know, moderate discount, especially because they're pretty reliable.
Yeah.
But that's exactly it. So those ones are only out now. The old tail beacon probably should still connect to the Aireon satellite, the ADS-B satellite network, but it's not certified to it. So.
Oh, okay. Darn it.
But I do know that there's a whole bunch of people from here flying down to Oshkosh this year, assuming the border's open.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe most of them do not have ADS-B.
Really?
Yeah.
Wild.
Me included.
That's cool.
Me included for now. We'll see when mine comes in. So.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I'd love to just go and land in one of those dry lake beds.
Now, here's the downside to ADS-B. In the U.S., you're not allowed to turn it off if you have it.
The moment you turn it off, if you never had it.
Yeah. Right. So if you don't have it, it's not a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so for privacy reasons, or say you're going somewhere where you don't want people knowing you're going, or you don't want people to track you.
Yeah.
Then you can't turn it off.
Oh, you guys talked about this with that fighter pilot.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that episode.
That's the big problem.
Yeah. That would suck.
But on the other hand,
go anonymous.
It's really great to have people track you and you know, watch out for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
Like your family or whatever.
Yeah. That's what I don't get about the old school ELTs, even the new 406s. Yeah. Like, it's such old technology. Come on.
Yeah, it's
go
so
get a
ancient.
Spot or a Garmin inReach.
That's exactly what I do. Come I fly on. With an inReach absolutely everywhere I go. Scott's always like, you forgot, did you land? I was like, oh, I turned it off before I sent the landing message. Yeah. Like, I'm good.
Yeah.
So, but I always fly with those. They're just such a better system.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy, this 406 ELT mandate, because it was ICAO initially recommended it in like 1997, I want to say. This is when they recommended everyone switch over to that one. It's like, I remember what computers were like back then. Yeah. They were, you know.
I wasn't even alive.
Exactly. They were terrible. Everything back then was awful. It's like, now this is what we're rolling out. You don't think we could maybe look to the future? So it's a bit of a nightmare there.
That's aviation for you, though.
Yeah. I'm going to be doing a little bit more of a deep dive on my YouTube channel about that. I talked about the inReach and the spots and stuff a few videos ago. And I'm going to be doing one a little bit on the 406 ELTs and the ADS-B and the whole privacy situation with ADS-B.
So quick question for you then. InReach or Spot, which is better?
InReach.
Is it?
Yeah, By far. Cool. They're more expensive, but they have much better coverage. And part of that's because, so the InReach actually uses the Iridium satellite network.
Okay.
Where when it sends a signal off, it's actually able to, if there's no ground station within that range of that satellite, it is able to bounce it off to the next satellite and verify that message actually gets to the ground.
Nice.
Whereas the way Spot works, unfortunately, is it transmits up to the satellite, and the satellite is kind of a dumb satellite, and all it does is rebroadcast it down. And if there's no ground station in the range, or if it's the ground station's behind a mountain compared to the satellite, you're just not getting that message down there. So they are significantly less reliable.
Yeah, that
and,
sucks.
Which really, it does really suck. Now, the inReach is a lot more expensive, but you do get the two-way communication, which I really like. So I've had times where Scott or my other friends, and they'll send me a text message on there, and I'll land, and they're like, oh, they sent me a message on here. It's kind of cool. But they're nice little, very nice little devices. It's what I use.
Cool,
I'll probably post a link below the video to my breakdown of that whole problem.
Yeah, you should, because I'm going to take the money I saved on with one. I bought an old 121.5 ELT instead of the new 406. Yeah. So, the money I saved on that, I'm going to put towards probably an inReach, I guess.
His inReach is way better in terms of functionality compared to my Spot.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't like a really old Spot, but it's like a brick, man.
Yeah. You'll see. We'll show the video. It's my Spot is the Spot version 1, the original.
It's probably what
monster
I got,
brick. Yeah, the thing's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, with the 406 ELT thing, everyone in Canada is going to be required to have that. Some people are saying it's by the end of this year. It's not. That's only for commercial operators. Some people flying commercially of any sort.
Yeah.
Okay. For us recreational guys, we need a 406 ELT within. So it's 5 years from that mandate. So it's about kind of 4.5 years from now.
Okay.
So you got a bit of time, and hopefully someone somewhere will be able to convince Transport Canada to get their head out. And
I hope so.
I'm keeping my 121.5 for so long.
Yeah, exactly. 3 days before, it's stick like it to Scott's installing the 406 ELT.
I'm not happy about this.
Anyways, well, should we wrap it up here?
Yeah, I think cool. We should.
Right on.
Thanks for coming on. And do you have any social medias or any kind of stuff you want to promote?
I guess I got.
What's your Instagram?
Instagram is KTookster. So KTookster.
Yeah, lots of base jumping.
Yeah.
Videos. There. Some aircoop stuff coming.
Should be a lot more coming if I get my C of A.
Yeah.
So it'll be pretty cool. My family actually just got a cabin down in Maple Lake. Okay. So we're going to have a whole bunch of fun down there this summer. So I'll be posting a bunch of that stuff. So other than that, Facebook, just Kieran Tukey. If you got any questions or whatever, you want to meet up, let me know.
Awesome.
I love talking.
We'll be sure to get up there flying, get some air-to-air video of that plane.
Yes, please. That'd be awesome.
We should take my kit fox out, take the doors off and get some like serious video.
That'd be cool. I'll bring my parachute with me.
Yeah, last time I tried to get the door open in his kit fox, I had my phone, and suddenly I feel my phone sliding out of my pocket. I'm like, door's coming closed.
It's scary.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.